say age is a matter of mind. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. But just so you know where my minding is at, I want to read you a little article that touched me, and I'll give you an idea. It's called Holding On. It's time to give up on the peaches. I figured this out the other day at the supermarket. Peach season is just about over. Oh, you can still get them if you want them. They're around $1.49 a pound, which comes to maybe 50 cents a piece. Which would be fine, except that under that smooth, firm, peachy gold exterior is a substance that reminds me a lot of cold, unbuttered mashed potatoes. Clearly, it's time to move on to apples. They're gorgeous, they're juicy, they're altogether toothsome. And they grow right here in Wisconsin, unlike the peaches, which come from 2,000 miles away and taste as if they were mailed here third class. So this all makes good sense. Why has it taken me until now, well past the peaches' prime, to figure it out? Simple. Even at this late date, I can't stand letting go of summer. With a peach in my hand, maybe I can pretend it isn't over. The minute I bite into an autumn apple, there's no more pretending. Never mind not going gentle into that good night. I don't even want to go gentle into a golden delicious. This denial thing, if you'll pardon the psychobabble, seems to get worse as I get older. Certainly everybody wants to postpone the end of summer, but it's not just fall that I fail to rise to. I can't seem to bear the thought of switching from shoes to boots each winter either. So I step out into the first snowfall, bare-ankled, as if I didn't quite remember what that white stuff was and how it feels when it melts on your skin. And when all that's over and spring finally arrives, it always takes me a while to pry open my window and invite it inside. Understand, I love spring. All the more so because in my lakeside corner of the world, it doesn't actually establish itself until sometime between Mother's Day and Father's Day. For the first week or so, though, I'm never sure I want to make a commitment to it. Last year, between a bad cold and the start of a part-time job, I even managed to put off my birthday dinner for a full month. Actually, I like celebrating my birthday even more than I like spring. I was just somehow not ready for my birthday when it came up on the calendar. Speaking of calendars, it generally takes me until somewhere between the 3rd and the 6th of the month to flip mine over. I'm just getting to like the February picture, the one with all the gray and white in it. And before I know it, it's March, and I just can't handle that much blue in a picture quite yet. I keep saying I don't know why this is, but I think I do. I used to think time marches on was just one of those inane things people say. But with every year that passes, I swear I can hear the sound of hobnail boots louder and louder, louder and clearer. Is it any wonder I hang back? Who wants to go on a forced march, even if it's just into March? Maybe if I keep the snowy picture up on the wall, postpone the birthday party, keep buying those out-of-season peaches until they're $1.89, and taste not like mashed potatoes but like wet paper mache, I can ignore the sound of those boots. Yes, and maybe when I wake up tomorrow, I'll be 17 again, too. Well, okay, enough of this. Wait right here while I get, you know, those apples aren't bad. Sir, this is where I'm coming from. At a point where I've come to a stage of life where I'm trying to hold on, as she calls it, holding on. And time has passed, and I recognize the truth of the reality that she's facing, that it's not just a cliche, that time doesn't back march on. Earlier this week, when I first got to town, I went to a wedding of one of our little boys that was born in Milwaukee. Our little boy, Ricky, who I remember his mother's difficult labor when she gave birth to him. And here he was up standing up there under the chuppah with his beautiful collar. And just for a moment there, I had a flash of his mother under the chuppah with her husband, which seems like it was only yesterday. I don't know where the time has gone to, but definitely time marches by. And what that does is, that's the kind of the nostalgic side of it. The other side of it, and the positive side of it, is that there is a certain consolation, because the consolation is that we do get a little bit wiser. As time goes on and we've experienced a lot, we've endured a lot, that we see things a little bit clearer, we can stop and we can re-examine premises and values, or the lack thereof upon which our lives have been structured up to this point. And we realize that we've kind of moved along, and one day leads into the next, that imperceptibly we just move along and we don't realize that all this time is kind of passing, and all of a sudden we find ourselves at a certain point in life, and it's time to take stock and to reassess and to figure out if this is in fact we are where we want to be. I was also at a seminar earlier today, and I used to go to seminars, and I was talking all these darling young faces, and all of a sudden I was the venerated senior member here, and it comes at it as a rude awakening. But as I said, the consolation is that there is a little wisdom that comes with it, and as we're told, Shalavicha v'yagetcha zikei necha v'yomer lach. When you want to have to gain someone to gain a handle on your life, the Torah encourages us to go to your father, ask your father, and even better, go to your grandfather and speak to your grandfather, gain from the benefit of the wisdom that they've acquired over these years. So now this brings me to the point. The point is this, the title, Excelling in the World. And all of this wisdom that I've acquired, it's not a whole lot, but enough so that I can tell you that excelling in two worlds is a misnomer. That there is really no way that you can be excellent in two worlds. You can be excellent, we can bring our finest and our best efforts. If we want them to actually be excellent, they have to be addressed in one area. We can do fine in both worlds, we can do very well, but we have to determine and decide which world we want to shine in, which world is going to get the best of our efforts. And this goes back a little bit. I want to share with you a word that my brother-in-law, Zichron Lebracha, once explained when he addressed the subject of Cain and Hevel and Bereishis. You remember what happened. I think the joke the kids run by us is, which was the world war where a quarter of the world was destroyed? And of course it's the world of Adam and Chava and Cain and Hevel. Hevel, as we know, Cain and Hevel were brothers, and Cain arose and killed Hevel. The situation was that Cain decided to bring an offering to the Almighty. He was the first one who thought of bringing a carbon to God, and he was a rich shepherd. Hevel was a poor farmer, and when Hevel saw that Cain had decided to bring this offering, the Gam Hevel, and also he decided to bring an offering. And we know that the Almighty accepted the offering of Hevel, the offering of the poor farmer, and rejected the offering of the rich shepherd, Cain. And Cain was terribly put off, and distraught, and upset, and envious. And the end of the story was that he got up and he killed his brother Hevel. So my brother-in-law, Zichron Lebracha, explained, he said, what happened here? After all, Cain, it was Cain's idea. He was the first one to think of it. And he was a wealthy shepherd. So obviously, he brought something that was worthwhile. He probably brought an animal that was a respectable animal. He said the point here was, why did Hashem accept the offering of Hevel? Because Cain, while he was a wealthy farmer, while he was a wealthy shepherd, Itaka did bring a fine animal, but it wasn't his finest. And Hevel, even though he was a poor farmer, Hevel brought his very finest fruit. He chose the finest of what he had and brought it to the Almighty. And therefore the Almighty accepted the offering of Hevel, because he had offered his finest and not the offering of Cain. Even though if you would have compared the two, compared to one another, the offering of Hevel of Cain was worth much more than the offering of Hevel. So the point is that it was Hevel's best and it wasn't Cain's best. And the point of this is that when we speak of excelling in worlds, we have to decide which world it is that we want to offer our very best to. And you can't offer your very best and your most excellent to two worlds. It's only one world. The other world, we can do well, but not our very best. It's only one area, and we have to prioritize, and we have to assess and reevaluate and think things through and figure out where we're at and determine which world is it that I want to give my finest to. Well, and the other world, by the way, doesn't have to suffer. And here, I want to read you something that my husband brought to my attention. It's really very cute. You probably have seen this book, All I Really Need to Know I've Learned in Kindergarten. So he has a cute little story. It takes a minute. It says, Elias Schwartz repairs shoes. He's short and round and bald and single and middle-aged and Jewish. An old-fashioned cobbler, says he, nothing more, nothing less. I happen to be convinced that he's really the 145th reincarnation of the Heil Lama. See, the Heil Lama died in 1937, and the monks of the Saskia Monastery have been searching for 40 years for his reincarnation without success. The New York Times carried the story last summer. The article noted that the Lama would be recognized by the fact that he went around saying and doing wise things in small, mysterious ways, and that he would be doing the will of God without understanding why. Through some unimaginable error in the cosmic switching yards, the Heil Lama has been reincarnated as Elias Schwartz. I have no doubts about it. My first clue came when I took my old bass loafers in for a total renewal. The works. Elias Schwartz examined them with intense care. With regret in his voice, he pronounced them not worthy of repair. I accepted the unwelcome judgment. Then he took my shoes, disappeared into the back of the shop, and I waited and wondered. He returned with my shoes in a stapled brown bag. For carrying, I thought. When I opened the bag at home that evening, I found two gifts and a note. In each shoe, a chocolate chip cookie wrapped in wax paper, and these words in the note. Anything not worth doing anything not worth doing is worth not doing well. Anything not worth doing is worth not doing well. Think about it. Elias Schwartz. The Heil Lama strikes again, and the monks will have to go on looking because I will never tell. We need all the lamas we can get. So he says, anything not worth doing is worth not doing well. It's worth doing whatever. So the point is that certainly anything worth doing is definitely worth doing well. So certainly whatever we undertake, in whatever world we function, whatever we decide to attend to is certainly worth doing well. But well and excellent are two different things. And by excellent, we mean giving it our very finest and our very best. Now let's talk a little bit. Let's identify the two worlds that we're talking about. We have two worlds, the external world, the world, the secular world, the world, the physical world, the world that the Rebbe Shalom told us, redu v'kiv shuva, this is the world I'm giving you, go out and conquer it. It's the professional world outside of the home that we find ourselves in. It's the world of Adama. It's the world of earth. It's the world of physicality. And it's very interesting that this world counts for a whole lot. And I shared with the women in the seminar earlier today an understanding of this that when I came across it, it really made sense. It kind of captures the essence of what it's all about. The beginning of Bereshis, you remember that Adam Adam was created. And Adam was created initially before he got his name, Adam. God told him, you know what, here are all the animals. He created all the animals in front of him. And he said to Adam, name them. And Adam, because of his being the raison d'etre of creation, being this sophisticated creature, being this the one that the Almighty invested everything in, was able to ascertain the mahus, the essence of each animal as it passed by him, and he was able to name it according to its essence. He gave it to each one of them, he gave a name that defined its essence. So then God turned to Adam and he said, okay, Adam, good job. Now tell me, what is your name? And Adam said to him, my name is Adam, because I was taken from Adam, which was a very curious kind of thing to do. Because after all, when we look at Adam, what is Adam? Adam is each and every one of us. What are we comprised of? We're comprised of Adam, our physical being, and we're comprised of what's even more important. What is that? A neshama. So if I'm comprised of these two dimensions, a neshama and a guf and adama, and if somebody asked me, if somebody asked you, what should I call you? Here you are, you got a neshama and you got adama. You're made up of these two elements. What do you want to be called? Neshama. What would you say? I would say neshama. Call me neshama, love. And Adam says, call me adama. Why did Adam say call me adama? Because Adam recognized that precisely the greatness of Adam and all of us who were there in the configuration of Adam as part of Adam, his greatness was that it was through Adama that he reached the Almighty. That the Almighty placed us in this world, in a physical world, in a material world, and we're the only beings that can take the physical and the material and use it in order to access the Almighty. Dafka through the physical we reach God. So we don't negate, we're not part of a Christian philosophy that says, do away with, we don't believe in the physical, we don't have any use for the material, as we shall. We definitely, but this is the way we access the Ribbono Shel Olam. All the mitzvahs we do, we have to use. We have money, we can give tzedakah. We have a husband, we can love him. We have children, we can raise them. We have, whatever it is, we have beautiful homes, we can have parties. We have beautiful shuls, we can get together for tzedakah purposes. It all takes place in the physical world. And the greatness of the human being is that we're able to take the physical and reach the spiritual, reach the neshamadika things through the physical. World number one, it's the world of Adama. Then there's the world of Panemius, there's the internal world. And the internal world is more the world, the inner stage of life. It's the private sector. The private sector meaning the world of the home, the world where we do raise children, the world where we're mothers, the world where we're wives. Not the outer, the public sector, but the inner sector. And of course they overlap a lot, but the major thrust of these two worlds, we can identify one as chitzonius and as one as pnimius. One is external and one is internal. And now the question is, how do we prioritize them? How do we figure out which one is more important, which one is less important? I think that the way that we need to do this, and of course in prioritizing them, then we will figure out in which world we want to be excellent and in which world we are going to just have to do the best that we can. So in order to do this, we have to sit down, we have to take out some time, and we have to assess our values. Look over, we go on, we move through life, like I said earlier, day to day, we keep moving, and we don't stop to think. Start to take a little bit quiet time. And to assess our values. Talk to people that we respect. Keep learning. Keep availing ourselves of information about Yiddishkeit, Jewish values, the thing that has hallowed, that which has hallowed our lives since we've been consecrated as a people. And then confront ultimate issues, which is very important. To ask ourselves a question. The question would really read something like, if Chas v'Shalom I had only 6 months to live, what would I do? You know, I'm sure you've all heard the saying that nobody's ever heard somebody on their deathbed say I wish I would have spent more time at the office. Nobody has been known to say that, but many people have been known to say, I wish I had spent more time with my family, I wish I had spent more time with my wife, my parents, so forth and so on. So we can bring all of those values into focus if we ask ourselves some of these questions. What would I want people to say about me when I wave the world goodbye? What would I want my epitaph to be? All these questions are important ways to figure out how to prioritize. Now, I think that I would like to share with you, if you'll bear with me, a very important Dvartora that I heard from my husband. You know, now we find ourselves in the Sedras of Bereshis. We're already, what is it, Vayera this week? So, okay, the Nechumish Sefer Bereshis. Sefer Bereshis, initially when we started out, you know, it was Yom Tov time. So maybe my husband has a way where the little things in life inspire him for the Great Torah. He doesn't necessarily go immediately into Rambams and Rashis and Sfarnos and so forth. He gets his inspiration of things that he sees along the way as he walks to shul. So this year, you remember Yom Tov. It was Yom Tov and Shabbos and Yom Tov and Shabbos and Yom Tov and Shabbos. And of course, what do you do when it's Yom Tov and Shabbos and so forth? Cook and eat. So my husband gets up at shul and he says, you know what? He says, all of you know that we've been eating a lot. And we know that our wives use a lot of ingenuity, because when you cook a lot, then invariably you'll have leftovers. So they want to doctor up these leftovers and make them look like they're not leftovers. So what do they do? And of course, he's giving away all my secrets here in public. So he says, so you take the chicken that's left over, you don't want to throw it out, so you cut it up into little pieces, and you fry some onions, so you saute onions and put the chicken in, and then you cook up some rice, and you serve it on top of rice, and then you come and you serve it, and you say, it's chow mein time, you know, and it's a new dish. So he says, Bereshis, say for Bereshis comes along, what does Bereshis mean? Bereshis means beginning. And Bereshis comes along and tells us, you know what, there's supposed to be a beginning. You're not supposed to come and serve the Rabbeinu Shel Olam leftovers. Not even doctored up leftovers, not even chamei. You're supposed to now, when it comes time of Bereshis, and we finish the year, and we finish that last word, the Na'inei Chol Yisrael, and the end of the Devarim, and it's time to move into Sefer Bereshis, Rabbeinu Shel Olam says, please, don't give me leftovers. Let's have a real, true beginning. Let's think it through as fresh, and let's reassess and reevaluate and start all over again. And the question is, how? Give me a clue. What are you talking about? So he went on to talk about the first parasha, Bereshis. And the Bereshis, you have that interesting story about Gan Eden and Adam and Chava, and how we erred in Gan Eden. So he went on to say, he said, you know what? What that teaches us is that in each and every one of us, because, you know, Torah is relevant. And it's not like we're supposed to, every year we learn the story. I mean, how many times can you go over that story? It's like they tell the story of an old woman who was in shul, and she heard the story of Yosef and his brother selling him into slavery. So she heard it the first year, and she cried her heart out. Next year in shul, she heard it again. She cried, not as much as the first year, the second year, a little less. Third year, it was, you know, she was more controlled. The fourth year, she comes to shul, she says, by this time, Yosef should have learned already, and he shouldn't have gotten into that kind of, I mean, after all, 4 years in a row, you know, how much sympathy does he expect to get? So Torah is supposed to be, you learn the Sedra, and you learn it over and over again. It's got to give us a message for here and now. So you come through and it's Bereshis. What is Bereshis telling us? So he said, we go through Gan Eden. And he said, every one of us has a Gan Eden within us. There's a part of us that is Gan Eden, and it's a part of us that we need to claim. At the same time, in addition to Gan Eden that's within us, there is also a Nachash within us, that primordial snake, the personification of evil, still resides in each and every one of us, and it still gives rise to the same sort of conflicts. The props are the same, are different, but the plot is the same all over again. The dynamics are the same. So again, we go through, if we look at our own lives, we're still confronted by the nachash, this snake, this primordial serpent, who's saying to us, come on, eat from the tree, buy into all of this other stuff, and v'yitzem kelohim, you know, you're going to be like God. You don't have to depend on anybody. You're going to be the source of your destiny. You're going to be able to control the world. You're going to be on top of it all. You don't have to answer to any God. The serpent is still, in our idiom, giving us the very same message. And at the same time, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam is moving through Gan Eden, and he's calling out, his voice is still reverberating and echoing in our lives, and saying to us, please, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you? Where are you? What have you done? How are you going to pick up the piece? How are you going to take control of your life so that you can make decisions? Decision-making is within our control. What the serpent told us, to be Yisam Kelo, that you could be like God, that's the control we can't assume. But control over our lives, assuming responsibility for our lives, even though we've all erred. But the Rebbeinu Shel Olam says, where are you? Come on, reassess, reevaluate. Where do you want to go? This is within your control. And so we still have this serpent trying to get us far afield, move us into the wrong world. And the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, on the other hand, saying to us, please, find the Gan Eden within you. And there's this conflict that's constantly going on within each and every one of us. And it's voices that we can hear. And when the Nachash does tell us, so what do? As Chava had done before and as Adam had done, they bought the invitation of the Nachash. But when God said, came along and said, assume responsibility, what does Adam turn around and do? He said, not my fault. She did it. Yeah, it's her fault. This woman you gave me. It's her fault. Just displacing all of this responsibility. And the Almighty exhorts us, it's time to stop displacing blame. It's time to take control of our lives, to make decisions in our life, to reevaluate, reassess, reprioritize, and in doing that, we'll find the Gan Eden that resides within each and every one of us. Voracious. Now, all of us want to make the right decisions. But when we're offered, the offer of the Nachash, the offer of the serpent, is very compelling and very inviting. He's offering us all the blandishments of the world out there. And we can all rationalize that, in fact, we can do a lot of good if we buy into it. And all of us are very good at rationalizing. We can make a contribution. We can grow if we give our very best efforts out there, even if it's to the detriment of our inner world, even if it's the detriment of our children, even if it's the detriment of our husbands and of family life and of chesed organizations. I can make a good case. I can rationalize it. And it's very hard having the Nachash pull on one side and the Rabbeinu Shel Olam talking to us on the other side. And we want some clarity. All of us honestly want some clarity. And here he wants to address something that also spoke to me. Moshe, at the end of his life, turns to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam and he says to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, Hareini es kvodecha, God, please show me your glory. I want to see clarity. Show me your face. I want to see things clearly. I want to know where I should make my contribution in life. I want to get some kind of focus in my life. Help me do that. And the Rabbeinu Shel Olam says to him, you know what? There is nobody who can see my face and live. In other words, total clarity in this world nobody will get. He says, but I will give you a clue. And he turned around and he let Moshe Rabbeinu see his back. And the Mefarshim say, what did Moshe Rabbeinu see in his back? Moshe Rabbeinu saw the Kesher Shel Tefillin, he saw the knot of tefillin. I say this to Derek. Him, you want to dedicate your life to something, you want clarity as to what should be the priority in your life, then it needs to be something where you have a kesher to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. That which creates a kesher, a bond, a connection, whatever is going to connect you in the greatest way to the source of our being, to the master of the world, that will be a clue as to what we should dedicate, what we should give our best efforts. What world we should excel in, that will give us a clue. And I remember a little story along these lines that they tell of one of my ancestors was Reb Meir from Shlom. And they say that when he was an elderly man, who was a saintly person, he used to get up very early in the morning and used to climb up a whole bunch of hills and mountains to get to a mikveh, which was a natural body of water to immerse himself in. So I used to do this daily at a regular time, very early, and a bunch of vandals decided that they were going to do this old man in. They were going to wake up at the same time, they were going to follow him, and they were going to beat him up and really take care of him. So they got up the next morning, followed him, and as he started moving up those mountains and hills, they were tripping all over the place, breaking their neck, and they absolutely could not believe that this old man could navigate this trip to this little stream without killing himself, and here they were barely alive. So they waited until he came down, and they approached him with new respect, and they said to him, "Rabbi, we really had every intention of doing a job on you, but now we can't believe what we saw here. You're an old man. How did you manage to get up there like that so deftly? And here we're so much younger than you, when we couldn't manage it." So he said to them, in Yiddish it goes, "As mitzige binen von oben, fällt man nicht von hinten," which means if you're connected, if you're bound upstairs, then you don't fall down below. If you're connected upstairs, you don't stumble down below. And that's the important in making decisions. We have to figure out what is it that will keep us connected to that which is above. And those things will in all likelihood keep us from making the wrong decision and from stumbling down below. Now, having said all that and having shared with you some heavy stuff, and you've been very good and stayed awake, I want to share with you some personal things. Just like all of you, I struggle with the same struggle, excelling in both worlds. It's a question of how much of our efforts we put out there, how much of our efforts do we take into the, which world becomes the world that we want to, that we should excel in. And what really struck home with me was Mati Yontif. We have by us a Anilas Hakag, kind of a Suda of sorts. Everybody gets together, the whole community. And you have Yom Tovim, you have Rosh Hashanah, you have Yom Kippur, you have Sukkot, and Shemini Atzeres, and Simchas Torah. So for a whole month, we're busy, you know, fabrengim together. And then comes the end of Yom Tov, and we're all together in shul. And my husband gets up, and he said, "You know, I have to share with you what happens to me soon after all of this, and other few moments will be here together. Then everybody is going to leave the shul, and the shul is going to become dark. All the lights are going to be shut off." And he says, "And I can't tell you what a feeling that gives me. Here in the dark, I'll be standing here in the dark, and this place that was teeming with action before, the sound of the shofar, the dancing with the Torah on some kastora, the lulavim and the srogim, all this wonderful action, and all of a sudden, darkness, lights off, nothing." And he says, "It's such a letdown, such a terrible, terrible sense of something gone by." He says, "And I probably would not be able to handle it other than the fact that because I had these wonderful experiences, because I was able to shake that lulav and esrog with all of you, and because I was able to listen to the shofar with all of you, and we danced and talked, that I have a place in my mind. It's all in my, a place that I can revisit. So when I'm down and when the lights are out, there's some place in my mind, in my being, in the recesses of my being, that I can move back there and revisit all of these wonderful occasions. And he says, you know, this is what we have when we learn now and all the sages, and we learn Noah, and we learn about Abraham. And our sages ask the question, what does the Torah start with? Gracious, we would have imagined the Torah should start with HaChodesh HaZalochem, with the mitzvahs in the Torah. What do we have here? Gracious is stories. Stories of Adam, and then stories of Noah and the Teva, and stories of Abraham and the Imahos. And what, no mitzvahs over here. Why? What do we... So he said, really, what these stories are, that these stories are our photo albums. These stories are the albums that we can revisit. These are the greats that preceded us. When a Noah was able to stand up against an entire world that was full of, bought into the depravity of that society, he was able to say, I'm sorry, I want no part of your world. Or an Avram who was able to be the first Ivri to stand on the other side of the world and say, I'm not buying into your idolatries. And what was the reward? What did they get as a result of that? As a result of their commitment to stand against the world and to say, I don't want any of your priorities. I don't want any of your values. I don't want any of your materialism. I don't want any of your me-ism. I want what's legitimately mine. As a result of that, what he was rewarded by was that here we are, all of us. We are his descendants. Because he was willing to stand against an entire world and stand up for what he believed, what he invested in each and every one of us, that ability, and he allowed for us to be here this evening. We are the progenitors of Abraham. So the Torah begins with that, so that when in our dark moments, when the lights are out in our lives, when we have dark moments, that we're able to revisit that photo album. Sefer Bereishis is a photo album. We look back there and we see those greats that preceded us, those greats that gave us the wherewithal to do that which we need to do. I have to interject here a personal note. Next week is the Yahrzeit of my father, of blessed memory. And when nobody should know from it, when one loses a parent, a lot of things are kind of, you get a new perspective on life. And you begin to realize what's really important to life. You begin to realize what really makes an impact ultimately. Who impacted on your life? You stop to think for a moment as we're busily hustling in the world out there, and you stop for a moment and you say, now, how much of a difference is all that going to make in my children's life? And all of that came into sharp focus after my father, Zichron Levracha, passed away, because I see that contrary to everything else, I see that my entire life, from the minute I wake up in the morning until the moment I go to sleep, everything that I do, it refers back to the Musti Yukno Shalavi, to that wonderful saintly image of my father, and what he's left me with. He's with me every moment. Now I'll tell you some things that are less significant and more significant. I find myself, I get up in the morning, and we have a two-story house. Bedrooms are upstairs. I come down in the morning, and the first thing that I do is I walk over to the drapes and to the shades, and I open up all the drapes in the house, all the shades. This is my father's from Avrocha. I live in Milwaukee. He lived in New York. I was the only one of my siblings where my father came to visit. He didn't pay to come to Milwaukee for an hour or two as he would to my siblings. Of course, he came for 3-4 weeks. So my father lived with us for that period of time. He would come down from upstairs, and he was not well enough oftentimes to go to shul. First thing, he would come downstairs and he would open all the shades. Sozam lechtik, sozam lechtik. I want it to be bright, I want it to be light. And this was very, you can only appreciate it if you knew my father was a person who my mother doted on totally and completely. He never did a thing. I mean, for him to open the shade, we would mamish stand there and applaud. How did he know which thing? He never took a glass, or he never opened a cap, you know, to get some water out of it. He never did such a thing. So this was a deliberate act on his part. He really had to want it badly to do it. And he would every single morning go over to those shades and open up those shades, and I would see him in Atul Sulzan Lechtik. And Sulzan Lechtik meant not only physical light. My father worked very hard on simcha, that it should be, we should have a light and bright attitude in life. The last 4 years of his life, he was blind. At the same time that he opened up the shades, I knew he would be having a particularly difficult day if he would start at that point singing, Mitzvah Gedola Leos Besimcha. There's a song that goes, it's a big mitzvah to be Besimcha. And I knew that he was really in bad shape, but he open up the shades, got the light going, and started singing Mitzvah Gedola Leos Besimcha. Every single morning, the first thing I come down, no matter how hurried I am, I don't know what moves me, I don't even know, but I know I find myself at the drapes, pulling the drapes, opening up the shades, the first thing. And when I do that, I have a sense my father's standing right there with me. Perhaps more important things. I'm living out of town. We get a lot of mishalachim. A lot of people come who are collecting on behalf of many institutions. And you know, you get all sorts of people, all sorts of, some look a little bit less than desirable when they knock at the door. And they come at all crazy hours. And my father's Zichrono Livracha was with me those 3 weeks. And sometimes I'm so tired, I'm ready to drop, and I want to turn in for the night. And then there's the doorbell rings, and a mishalach is here. And of course, he's out of town. I look at him and I say, you know, and I see him and I know what it's like. Unfortunately, Rav Tzentzeta told you we have institutions now, so I've become a fundraiser. We have to support institutions. I have a new appreciation for mishalachas. You know, to be able to raise funds to keep institutions going is a formidable task. And I look at them and they're weary and they're tired, they've traveled. And I'll always say to them, are you hungry? Do you want something to eat? And usually they take me up on it. And they come in and try to put something together for them. And I remember so clearly, and it never leaves me, my father would be there, and he would be. And he would say, Oi, taire tochter, dost azam mitzvah, kikyun ayit, ost mechaye geven ayit. You have such a mitzvah, you brought life to a person who's so tired and so worn and hasn't had a good word and has something warm to drink or to eat. And his face would be. There isn't a time that I take care of mishalach now, and I look for the mishalach, because when the mishalach come and I give him to eat, I see my father. I see my father standing over my shoulder and beaming. All of these are images these are the things that impact on our life. My mother, Yibadal Chayim, she should live and be well. I could tell you that my mother, my husband, still says that all these books that were written, my mother, myself, you know, that someday a daughter ends up being like a mother. My husband keeps saying, when is it going to happen already? When they made my mother, they threw out the mold. It's just the kind of doting she did on my father. They breathed in unison. She would breathe when he breathed. When she was deathly sick, how she cared for him. I mean, it's just, it doesn't pay to tell about it because you wouldn't believe it. But I can tell you that as for myself, when I went to school and I would come home, there would never, ever be a time that my mother wouldn't be home when I came home from school. I can't say the same thing about myself. I'm striving to achieve that, but I can't say that. I can still smell the smell in the house. Of course, the smell, she stayed up all night Thursday night baking challahs and all the delicacies. You woke up Friday morning, it was waking up to Gan Eden. I mean, there was never a question of what, I never had to look for a definition for Shabbos. I couldn't even tell it to you. You would have to be there to taste it and to smell it. But coming home from school, the first thing I would do is run into the kitchen. And with my coat on, my mother still makes, to this day, she reminds me, she says, do you remember, with my books in my hands, I used to go and lift up all the lids and see, what's that stuff? What's smelling? What smells so good? I was stopped, but more importantly than what was smelling so good was that my mother was always there. I never had to say, now, as my children sometimes say to me today, Mom, are you going to be home? when I come home today, I never had to pose that question because it was never a question. My mother was always there. And I can tell you one time, and this is what I was trying to achieve my a descent, you know, the self-hypnosis that relaxes you. And I had some very tense moments, and my son was on the phone with me, and he does the self-hypnosis, which has never worked for me. I went to people to try, they should teach me hypnosis, and they're telling me, close your eyes, you're relaxing, you're going down the stairs. They might be going, I'm going nowhere. I don't know. My husband once came along with me because there was a man who was doing it, and he didn't want me to be alone, and I hear my husband snoring in the corner. And I have budged in this. So the other night I was telling my son, you know, I was trying to do what I see them do, you know, you feel the warmth that's getting in. And so he said, Mom, why don't you revisit those important places in your life? I said, like what? He says, why don't you revisit the sour apple? I have to tell you what the sour apple is. I actually wrote it in one of my articles, but it pays to retell the story. When I was a little girl, I was very ill at one time, and had a very, very high fever. And I just remember that every time I opened my eyes for a minute, whether it was night, day, my mother was always sitting there in the chair beside me. And I came to that moment of consciousness each time she would say to me, about something to eat. How about a drink? And I fall back and again, and she said, please, take a drink. How about something to eat? Couldn't do it. Finally, I got up and I was feeling a little bit better. My mother said again, you know, can I get you something to eat? I would like is a big green sour apple. And since that time, every time that I speak to my mom on the phone and she senses that I'm a little bit down, she always says to me, you want a big green sour apple. So my son knew that the comfort of knowing that in times when the lights are out and when you're feeling down and distressed, that one of those wonderful places in the recesses of my heart and my mind is that place with the sour apple. If I could go back there and touch that moment, then I would get some relief from whatever anxiety that I was experiencing at the time. So the point of all this, and I can tell you that I watch very carefully with my children, because I want my children to have that kind of photo album. I want my children to have memories like that they can revisit. And what I try to do for them is that I watch very carefully the compositions they write in school. And with all this traveling and all the other things that I do, I want to see what they write when the teacher says, describe your mom. So I know that my older children, when I was home more, always used to write, my mom is the best cooker and the best baker in the world. And now I watch very carefully if that will change, if the description of their mom isn't going to be the best cooker and the best baker, and that they can find their mom in the kitchen, that I know it's going to be time to reevaluate and reassess my life. That's the definition that I want, because that's the memory that they'll be able to eventually revisit. I want my children to see me davening, and I make a point of that. I want them to have memories of that they saw their mother davening, because this is how they will define themselves. I want my children, I'm happy that my children see the chesed and the mishalachim and all those things that go on in the home. If you ask my children of what their earliest memories are, they will tell you about our friend Lorraine, when they were tiny little kids in the old house on a Friday night, when she came in so distraught and to share with us that her father had just passed away, and then she needed comforting. To this day, they remember her cries. And they'll say, do you remember Lorraine? Actually, at that time, they didn't call her Lorraine. They called her Relaine. So they couldn't say Lorraine. But now they're married and they have children of their own, but they'll never forget Relaine and what happened on their Friday night. And they've forgiven me for many of the times that I haven't been there when I should have been there, because they understood that I was out doing a tara for somebody who passed away, who needed attending to before they were buried. They knew that we were out there comforting the sick and then comforting the bereaved, the Nechem Lachmanetzam, Nechem Aveilim, and so forth. And so they forgive me for this some of the times, but at least
they know that they, these are still wonderful memories that they can have, and I want them to reconstruct those memories in their lives. So I think that it's important for us when we read through these cedras, cedra of Veracious, that we understand that it's gracious. It's time for a new beginning. It's not just time for, what do you call things, a hash? What are the things called that are recooked? Rehashed. You know, rehashed stuff that's been hashed and rehashed. Same old stuff from last year. Veracious invites us. No, it's got to be veracious. It's got to be a beginning, a new beginning. It's time to sit down and to look at our own photo albums and to see what kind of photo albums we're creating for our children. What kind of memories are we creating for our children? And it may take us in a little bit of a different direction than direction that we're going up till now. And we have the wherewithal to do that, because our avos and our imahos, avos imahos mean parents. Parents means that we have their genes. Abraham was able to stand against an entire world. That means we can do that too. And even though the world out there beckons to us and invites us to be part of that world, the world invites us to give our best and our finest and the most excellent to the world out there, but we have the wherewithal to let that world be and say, no, that's not where I'm going. I'm not following you. I'm going in the direction of where I can create these wonderful memories for the generations that will follow me, as the generations that preceded me provided for me. So when we go through the Sedra this week, let's pay attention very carefully to that photo album, those who preceded us, because that should give us a clue as to what world we want to work solid and what world we want to give our secondary efforts to. Thank you very much.